Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome. It's FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 16th, 2025, we're delighted to host a second Courthouse Steps oral argument on Louisiana v. Calais, following its re-argument before the court yesterday. If you're getting deja vu, don't worry, I am too, but we have a fabulous panel here to help explain it all. For those who haven't seen me on your screen before, hello, I'm Kayla Kleist, I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Professor Michael Domino, who's professor of law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School, where he teaches courses related to constitutional law, election law, federal courts, statutory interpretation, and criminal law. He's a two-time recipient of Widener's Douglas E. Ray Award for Faculty Scholarship, a two-time recipient of the Ascending Professor Award, an elected member of the American Law Institute, and Fulbright Scholar. Professor Domino has written extensively on constitutional law, free speech, and election law, and has co-authored several books, including Voting Rights and Election Law, Congressional Investigations and Oversight, The Best Candidate, Presidential Nomination in Polarized Times, and Understanding Election Law and Voting Rights. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Bradley Benbrook, who is a founding partner at Benbrook Law Group. Mr. Benbrook has over 25 years of experience litigating business and public policy matters across the United States. He represents companies of all sizes in civil disputes and proceedings against regulatory agencies, and also regularly advocates for individuals, companies, advocacy groups, and industry associations in constitutional and public policy litigation at both the trial and appellate level. Mr. Benbrook has briefed and argued appeals throughout California and in multiple federal courts of appeal, and frequently submits amicus briefs to the Supreme Court of the United States in significant cases. And I will leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Benbrook, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shyla. Very happy to be with you all and to have the opportunity to ask Professor Domino some questions about what could be one of the most important cases of this term. This case, Louisiana versus Calais, is a racial gerrymandering case, but it also involves application of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the vote dilution test from the 1986 Thornburg versus Jingles case, a Brennan decision and one of the very last gifts to America from the Warren Burger Court. States often argue to courts that they are stuck between a rock and a hard place when it comes to race and redistricting, where Section 2 claims are the rock and racial gerrymandering claims, on the other hand, are the hard place. And this is the first case where the Supreme Court has finally taken up that dilemma, which is why it could be so important. Mike, could you give our listeners a little background on the rock and the hard place problems for states like Louisiana here?
Certainly. And thanks, Brad, for moderating this discussion. Thanks to Kayla for setting it up and the Federalist Society for hosting it. This case is, as you mentioned, a racial gerrymandering challenge to the district that'll be on your screen in a moment. It is a very long district. It's approximately 250 miles, ranging from Shreveport in the northwest corner of Louisiana to East Baton Rouge, and including several other pockets along the way. The reason that the district is drawn this way is to include a bunch of different portions of the state that have large Black populations. The district is drawn on purpose. The state admits it, even if it weren't obvious from the shape of the district, but drawn on purpose to be a majority-minority district. That is to say, the state consciously focused on race in deciding what the boundaries of this district should be. And so the challengers are alleging that this is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, that it violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause specifically, in its predominant focus on race. Now, what a racial gerrymandering claim involves is an argument that the state, when it constructed a district, not only considered race somewhat, but considered race as the predominant factor, that it was the factor that could not be compromised, or at least it was one of the factors that could not be compromised. And the rule that the Supreme Court has established in a series of cases, beginning with Shaw versus Reno in the 1990s, is that if the state draws districts with the predominant focus on race, that's unconstitutional unless the state has a compelling interest in considering race to that extent. Another way of putting this is that if you draw districts with a predominant focus of race, it triggers strict scrutiny. The district is presumptively unconstitutional, but the state can say that the can save the district from unconstitutionality if it has a compelling reason for considering race the way that it did. And Louisiana's primary argument here on re-argument is that it did have a compelling interest in drawing the district this way, and the compelling interest was complying with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And this goes to your question about the rock and a hard place problem. Because the state is saying, yes, we understand that the racial gerrymandering cases place a limit on the extent to which we can use race. On the other hand, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act requires us to consider race. And so if we consider race enough to satisfy our requirements under the Voting Rights Act, and that gets us sued under the Constitution for drawing a racial gerrymander, well, then we're stuck. And so it's necessary, as you intimated at the beginning, it's necessary for us to understand not just the racial gerrymandering cause of action, but also the requirements under Section 2. And so I'll take a few minutes now and explain the basics of a Section 2 cause of action, because that's what the state here was trying to avoid. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act provides that states may not use voting practices or procedures that have the effect of discriminating against minority voters with regard to voting. And Section 2 goes on and is a little more specific on the point by saying that a violation of Section 2 is established if, after considering the totality of the circumstances, a racial minority or a language minority group, in the case of Hispanics, lacks an equal opportunity to access the political process and elect representatives of its choice. The court has had to figure out what this means and how to apply it. And Thornburg versus Jingles, the case that you earlier mentioned, was the first case that the Supreme Court had that tried to give some content to this provision. The Voting Rights Act, of course, has been around since 1965, but this language in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act has been was enacted only in 1982. So we're talking about interpreting the 1982 amendments to the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
And Mike, the 1982 amendments were put into place in response to a very high profile vote dilution claim called Mobile versus Alabama. So it was a response to that.
Right? Yeah, the plurality opinion in Mobile versus Bolden said Bolden. that the 15th Amendment, amendment that bans racial discrimination in voting, bans only intentional discrimination on the ground of race. And the court, or the plurality, written by Justice Stewart, the plurality opinion said that the Voting Rights Act, as it was written at the time in 1980, did nothing more than the same thing that the 15th Amendment already did. So the 15th Amendment bans only intentional discrimination on the ground of race. The Voting Rights Act as of 1980, also banned only intentional discrimination on the ground of race. Congress didn't like that, so it rewrote Section 2 in 1982 and made it clear that states may not adopt voting practices or procedures that have the effect of denying voting rights to members of racial minority groups. The Thornburg versus Jingles case had to figure out, well, what kinds of voting practices or procedures do have the effect of denying an equal opportunity to minorities to access the political process and elect representatives of their choice? And in particular, how do we apply that standard when we're talking about drawing district lines? Thornburg versus Jingles, in fact, happened to be a challenge to a multi-member district for state legislators. But the court has since taken Thornburg versus Jingles and applied it to single member districts, including congressional districts, in subsequent cases. So the standards that we apply come ultimately from this 1986 decision in Jingles. And the court in Jingles said there are three preconditions that need to be satisfied by plaintiffs when they're trying to make out a Section 2 claim. And the first is that the minority group has to be sufficiently large and geographically compact so that it would be possible to draw a majority-minority district. If you don't have enough minorities in the state, or if they're spread around in such a way that you couldn't construct a compact district that includes a majority of minority races, then you don't have any kind of right under Section 2 to get a majority-minority district. And the second and third.
Can I jump in real quick? Sorry. So we're going to flag that and we're going to come back to that point because it's a very important point when you talk about constructing these huge congressional districts and putting, linking parts of cities across the state. In Thornburg versus Jingles, as you mentioned, it was a multi-member district, but it wasn't a multi-member district for like the city council. It was a multi-member district for the state legislature, which is extremely weird and really only explainable as a way to not have Black voters be able to elect their candidate because they would divide up Mecklenburg County into a district that had four legislative members. Very weird. And the court stressed these districts are so small that it's possible that, you know, for the district sizes, as we pointed out in an amicus brief, were roughly 100,000 people per district. And it was very easy to have a majority minority district when you're talking about populations that small. So sorry to interrupt. I just wanted.
Oh, of course.
This concept really. We're going to come back to this concept and show and talk about how inapplicable it is to congressional districts that are over 700,000 people.
And you're right that those multi-member districts are weird, especially now. Historically, they weren't quite as weird. From the colonial times forward, it was more common to have multi-member districts, but they do strike us as more odd. Now, and congressional legislation, federal statute requires that congressional districts be single member districts. So if we're talking about state legislative districts or local councils, like you said, there's always the possibility of a multi-member district. But we haven't been able legally to draw multi-member congressional districts in several decades. The other two preconditions that Jingles said that a plaintiff has to establish are that the minority group must vote sufficiently as a block so that the minority group has preferred candidates. And the third is that the white voters must vote sufficiently as a block in order to defeat the minority's preferred candidates. So we tend to combine preconditions 2 and 3 and call them racially polarized voting, which in practical terms means the minority group votes one way, the whites vote another way. And if you establish all of those three, the the sufficiently large and geographically compact minority group and racially polarized voting, then you advance to a totality of the circumstances test. And if the court concludes that under the totality of the circumstances, the minority group is unable to exercise that equal opportunity, then the state has to redraw the districts in such a way as to give the minority group a better opportunity. In practice, of course, that means that states are sometimes required to draw majority-minority districts or additional majority-minority districts. And that's what happened in this case. So maybe you want to mention the Robinson case that is kind of the precursor to this litigation in Calais?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so the dynamic here played out where Section 2 plaintiffs filed a case called Robinson, saying to a district court judge, notwithstanding the fact that for the last 40 years, Louisiana has only always had one congressional district, and notwithstanding the fact that in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, the Department of Justice pre-cleared all of those district maps, and notwithstanding the fact that instead of having seven seats, we now have six seats, Your Honor, in 2023, I think, when this was filed, Louisiana needs to go to two majority black congressional districts. And the district court granted a preliminary injunction, which is what caused Louisiana to have to scramble and draft the map, draw the map that Mike shared on the screen, which begat the Calais case in a district part, a different part of Louisiana, litigated by our fellow member of the Executive Committee for Elections at the Federal Society, Eddie Grime. So we give a shout out to Eddie for that. And that court said, yes, this 250-mile-wide district that Mike showed on the screen that links three separate parts of Louisiana to collect different black populations is a racial gerrymander that violates the Constitution. So that got us to the Supreme Court.
And it well illustrates the rock and a hard place problem, that this isn't just some kind of hypothetical worry that in the abstract, there's some concern that we're being pulled in two different directions. Louisiana said, look, we got sued by people from the left and on the right for drawing our districts. We tried to draw districts that had one out of six majority minority districts. We got sued by a group of plaintiffs who demanded under Section 2 that we draw a second one. And as you mentioned, the district court in that case issued a preliminary injunction and said, there's still a trial that we haven't held yet, but we think there is a likelihood of success for the plaintiffs. We think it's likely that the plaintiffs will succeed in a Section 2 claim, and that if you don't draw a second majority minority district, we are likely going to draw one for you. And Louisiana said, well, we don't want that because the district court might draw a second majority minority district that's going to jeopardize a couple Republican incumbents that we really care about staying in Congress, including Speaker Johnson. And so the legislature said, well, if we have to create a second majority minority district, we'll create it this way. That'll leave our incumbents in place. And then they got sued from on the basis of a claim that this was a racial gerrymander because race predominated. So the state says, yes, we understand that there's this requirement that we not draw districts with a predominant focus of race, but we have a compelling interest in doing so because the Voting Rights Act gives us no choice. And what this case turns out to be about then is whether compliance with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as it's been interpreted since Jingles, is in fact a compelling interest that justifies the predominant use of race in drawing these majority-minority districts.
Mike, that's a great setup. And so I want to ask you just one important last question before we transition to the oral argument, because a lot of people, a lot of media coverage is saying the result of this case could be that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act gets thrown out, gets found to be unconstitutional. Now, I don't agree with that. That's not the question presented. I think the question really, as you're setting up, is whether the Jingles interpretation and application of the section of Section 2 is unconstitutional. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right, that the people who are challenging this district aren't seeking to strike down Section 2 in its entirety. They're certainly not seeking to do away with Section 2 in any applications other than with regard to redistricting. And as I said before, Section 2 applies to all manner of voting practices and procedures, not just where you draw the district lines, although districting is one of those procedures that affects voting. So there is no chance here that the Supreme Court will eliminate Section 2 for all purposes. But it could have a very significant impact on the ability of plaintiffs, particularly the minority plaintiffs and Democrats, to use Section 2 as a way to demand that Republican-controlled states draw additional Democratic districts that are controlled by minorities.
Okay, so let's transition to the oral argument, how that went. And I like to set up the discussion this way, because a lot of our listeners, I think, will want us to hone in on whether the conservatives have at least 5 votes to do something significant here. So to answer that, I think we start with Allen versus Milligan, where 2 years ago, the Chief Justice wrote an opinion that involved very, very similar facts for the state of Alabama. Just like here, a federal district court told Alabama that for the first time, it needed to have a second majority Black congressional district. That court ordered Alabama to adopt a map that stretched across Alabama and broke up traditional districts. And Alabama asked the Supreme Court to treat that remedial district as a racial gerrymander, but the court didn't take up that question explicitly. The court rejected Alabama's arguments 5-4, with Justice Thomas, Alito, Barrett, and Gorsuch dissenting, all saying things in dissent fairly similar to what the plaintiffs in Calais are saying, namely, Jingles is out of control, and this remedial district is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. And so, to me, the focus, I think, should be on Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh. And when the Section 2 plaintiffs at oral argument yesterday were making that point, saying, hey, what happened to Allen versus Milligan? We were just here 2 years ago talking about this same stuff. I found it ominous for the Section 2 plaintiffs that the very first thing the Chief Justice Roberts said in argument was, well, Allen versus Milligan, quote, took the existing precedent as a given and only dealt with how it was applied. What did you make of that, Mike? And does it give you some comfort that revisiting Jingles is on the agenda?
I do think it's a signal to that effect. And not only was it the first question that Roberts asked, but it was almost the first question of the entire oral argument. Justice Thomas asked the first question, but then immediately after that, Roberts asked this question about whether Allen versus Milligan was really going to constrain the court from revisiting some of these questions in this case. And it seemed to be a signal that Roberts at least considers those issues to be on the table, that at least the way that he looks at what he wrote a couple of years ago, he seems to say, well, we addressed the arguments that Alabama was making in that case. We found them to be unconvincing. But if Louisiana or if Calais and friends are making better arguments in this case, well, then the fact that we addressed similar issues and found in favor of Section 2 plaintiffs in Allen versus Milligan shouldn't preclude us from addressing the better arguments that are being brought in this case.
Yeah. And so in that regard, one of those arguments that Justice Kavanaugh mentioned in his concurrence, he was in the majority, but also wrote separately to say, hey, you know, no one's making the argument here that Section 2's remedial scheme, or at least as it's being applied, should be subject to temporal limits. And that is another one of Chief Justice Roberts' favorite themes over the years, is that when it comes to race, America has changed considerably over the last 50 years. We saw this in his Shelby County decision, where he struck down the preclearance regime for Southern states. We certainly saw it in Harvard, which the chief wrote. And Justice Kavanaugh picked up that theme in Allen versus Milligan. And again, so the Harvard case stressed that race-based remedies have to have an endpoint that cannot go on forever. So did Justice Kavanaugh press those themes yesterday, and how do you think that could play out here?
He certainly did. And I'll add one thing to your description of Milligan, which was very fine and went to the heart of an important issue, that the Kavanaugh concurrence was in part a regular concurrence, but also in part a concurrence in the judgment. So part of Allen versus Milligan was only a plurality opinion. That Kavanaugh specifically wrote to say, this argument has not been pressed. I consider it to be important, maybe more persuasive than anything else that has been actually litigated by Alabama. And so I'm serving notice now that in a future case that is arguing this temporal point, that I might revisit this question. And Louisiana versus Calais is pretty much just taking Justice Kavanaugh up on that invitation. There are more issues involved in the case. The court could go a different kind of way. But at bottom, it's not at all surprising that the court considers the constitutionality of Section 2, or say the continuing constitutionality of Section 2, to be a matter that is in doubt, that is fair for argument. Because four justices were willing to say in Allen versus Milligan that it was unconstitutional. And the one said, well, yeah, it might be unconstitutional, but for a reason that hasn't been argued here. So I'm going to put that off for another case. So if all that the Calais plaintiffs do in this case is maintain the four justices who were on their side 2 years ago and pick up Kavanaugh by making that argument that he thought was stronger than the ones that Alabama offered in Milligan, then they win the case. And the only question then becomes whether Roberts goes along and makes it 6-3 instead of 5-4, makes it 6, because there's no question that the three liberals are going to vote to keep Section 2 the way that it is. I don't think there's much doubt that Alito, Thomas, Barrett, and Gorsuch are going to stick with their position. So as you astutely reasoned, that Roberts and Kavanaugh are the only ones that are really in doubt. And if Kavanaugh flips, then that's the fifth vote.
Yeah, and so this logical endpoint, I think it's worth for the listeners to have some context. This isn't just sort of a theoretical cop-out of any kind. I mean, it's just at a big picture, it's worth stepping back and thinking, okay, in 1980, in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, when you've got a tiny multi-member district that's being used as a way to prevent black voters from electing candidates they want to choose, where in that circumstance, white Democrats wouldn't vote for black Democrats. We live in a very different world now, particularly when you're talking about congressional districts. The Jingles case, as has been stressed over and over again, is premised on racial segregation. If you don't have intense racial segregation, the test doesn't work and doesn't make sense. And despite that, 50 years later, and despite much less prevalent racial segregation, as has been measured and shown repeatedly, district courts throughout the South are finding, as we mentioned earlier, for the first time in the 2020s, states have to draw a second majority minority district. You step back and say, how can this possibly be? The reason it's happening is because Jingles allows them to do it.
The funny, ironic kind of twist that at the one hand, you find that there's more racial integration in society, at least by some measures, than there had been. But the use of computer technology and districting also makes it possible to go and seek out smaller pockets of Black voters. And so you can do more to draw a squirrely district like this one now than you could have in the past. And that's part of the argument that the Calais plaintiffs were making, that said, what Section 2 practically does is it gives a right for minority groups, even though it's not written in group terms, it gives a right to minority groups to have proportional representation among congressional seats and state legislative districts. Now, this is despite the fact that the last line of Section 2 says we're not creating a right to proportional representation, but in practice it largely does, because even though the minority groups have to show that they're sufficiently large and geographically compact to make up a majority in a single member district, if you can draw a district like this in order to create a majority minority district, well, then geographically compact doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot. And so although the court has continued to cite compactness as an important traditional redistricting criterion, it has never really said what compact means. It has never provided a measure for measuring compactness. And there's obviously nothing in the statute that restricts the ability to create majority-minority districts unless they meet some particular measure of compactness. And when
I should amend what I said earlier, that I said Jingles allows it. I mean, I don't think a fair reading of Jingles does allow what's going on, but that doesn't prevent district courts from reading it unfairly.
And that was part of the debate in some of the other Section 2 cases, including Allen versus Milligan, where Justice Alito argued that we don't have to overrule Jingles. We just have to make sure that we're interpreting Section 2 the right way. And he argued in accordance with what Jingles said. But of course, there's a disagreement about that. I think you're right that as a practical matter, the district courts have taken the Jingles preconditions and applied it rather mechanically.
I thought the Solicitor General, both Solicitor Generals, Solicitor General of Louisiana, which interestingly has switched sides in light of the new question presented. This is a re-argument, which also could be significant in itself, did a good job of tying this sort of regime of basically setting aside districts and drawing lines, as you say, with computers, say, okay, well, we're going to get a few more Black voters here and a few less white voters there. Really, in a post-SFFA versus Harvard world, sounds a lot like affirmative action for politicians. And it shows the significance of the Harvard case, because it just makes all of these arguments sounds different in 2025.
So, and the point that you made earlier is absolutely true with regard to this too, that if we do what you say and take kind of big picture look at things and say that where we use race, it should be as a last resort. It should be when there's no other alternative. It should have a logical endpoint. It's to look at these kinds of districts and say, well, we're going to create a perpetual right to proportional districts on the ground of race. It can't be what Section 2 was designed to mean. And so the thing the court is going to have to deal with is that really what Section 2 means? So the statutory interpretation, can we revisit Jingles or some of the post-Jingles cases that have interpreted what Section 2 means and say the statute was improperly interpreted, or we've gotten off the rails at some point here, and we're going to set things right just as a matter of statutory interpretation? Or if this really is what Section 2 means, is it unconstitutional when it is applied to force districts, to force states to draw districts when they have a predominant focus on race?
Right. So that's a great segue in terms of what the result could be. And I can't resist, we may not have Jingles to kick around much longer. So I want to note, in classic Burger Court Justice Brennan fashion, the three-part test you described was completely made up. It was never briefed or argued for that test. The parties weren't asking for it. It just appeared in the decision. And this makes me sort of wonder or think of a different and more recent text-based decision, the Brnovich decision, which interpreted Section 2 as applied to voting practices. And Justice Alito wrote that opinion, and it was somewhat revolutionary because it was the first Voting Rights Act opinion that actually paid close attention to the text of the Voting Rights Act rather than the so-called Senate factors legislative history. Do you think it's possible the court could revisit Jingles by tying it more to the statutory text as in Brnovich?
I certainly think so. In fact, I think the argument is far easier in this context than it was in Brnovich, because although you're correct, of course, that the court portrayed itself as paying much more attention to the text of the Voting Rights Act in Brnovich than had existed in the past, there was a decent argument on the other side that the court really was ignoring the equal opportunity language in Section 2. And so I'm a textualist and statutory interpretation myself, and so I think regardless of the outcome that you get, that the approach that focuses on the text is more likely to be the correct way to interpret the statute. But to get that the result in Brnovich was arguable, the result in this case, far less so. I think if you adopt a textualist approach to this statutory interpretation problem, the result is super clear. And not just because the terms that Congress used are precise, but because the significant language in Section 2, the equal opportunity to access the political process and elect representatives of their choice, came from a Supreme Court decision about 9 years before, in the 70s, a case called White versus Register, where the court was interpreting the constitutional requirement that states not draw districts to discriminate against minority groups. And in that opinion, written by Justice White, the court said that there is a constitutional violation if state draws district lines or uses other kinds of voting procedures so as to deprive minorities of that equal opportunity to access the political process and elect representatives of their choice. Congress cut and pasted that language and put it into the amended Section 2 in 1982. And yet Jingles didn't say that what this new amended Section 2 means is exactly what this court was meaning when it wrote that same language that Congress took the language from. That was the opinion of Justice O'Connor, who wrote a partial dissent in Thornburg versus Jingles. And that's what her argument was look at where this language came from. It came from White versus Register. What Congress was trying to do was to say, we want the White versus Register standard back. We don't want what this court, or at least the plurality of the court, did in Mobile versus Bolden, kind of simplify it by focusing exclusively on intentional discrimination. So Congress was trying to use Section 2, when it amended it, to get at more than just intentional discrimination, but those circumstances where the state's laws combined with local conditions made it more likely that there would be this more systemic, the bigger systemic problem that minority voters wouldn't be able to access the political process. Not just that they wouldn't get proportional results from elections, but that they would have these barriers to accessing the political process. Justice O'Connor, I think persuasively, said in Thornburg versus Jingles, that's what Congress was trying to reestablish. And so if the court today goes back and looks at Section 2 and applies a more textualist methodology, they're more likely to say O'Connor's view was should have carried the day. We should go back to that. Or Justice White, of course, as I mentioned, who wrote White versus Register, he also wrote a separate opinion in Thornburg versus Jingles, not agreeing with all of Justice Brennan's analysis. And the court could go back and say Justice White had it right all along. But either case means that there would be a considerable reinterpretation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that would make its constitutionality much less of a question. The constitutional problem that is being caused here is because Section 2 has been interpreted to create this kind of quasi-proportional representation right. And that runs square into the racial gerrymandering cases. But if Section 2 is reinterpreted to mean something more in line with this bigger systemic access to the political process kind of concern that I think it was, then there isn't a conflict between the racial gerrymandering cases and Section 2. Section 2 is going to align much more closely with what the 15th Amendment actually requires.
That's a fantastic summary, Mike. I appreciate that. So I think it's beyond our ability to forecast what the political implications of this would be. One question I would ask in terms of whether this could play out in the next cycle, do you think it's likely that this opinion will come out in time for the drawing of the finalization of maps for the 2026 cycle? Or do you expect this to be held until June 30 or so, where it's probably too late?
I do expect the decision to be pretty quick, although I'm not confident in that prediction. So the reasons that I think that the answer is yes, that they'll come out fairly early, is that this is a re-argument. The case has been at the court for a year. That was argued first in March, re-argued again in October. So it seems to me that the court will have been working on this over the summer. The court isn't just going to start considering these problems now. I think it's already had at least a 6-month head start on this. The second thing is that, of course, the court is aware of the electoral timelines, and it will want to get the case out in time to have an effect on the next elections. The court in cases from Purcell versus Gonzalez 15 or 20 years ago has been critical of courts that come out with kind of late-breaking decisions that force changes to election laws. So the last thing the court's going to want to do here is to put itself in that kind of position to issue a decision around the time that congressional primaries are going on, right, and screw up those kinds of things. Right. So there's a lot of pressure. I think the court's going to want to try to get a decision out by January. But, of course, the case is going to be extremely controversial. The dissenters are going to write their kind of firebrand, sky is falling kind of dissents. And there's going to be a typical back and forth between the majority drafting and the dissents. So usually the more controversial a case, the longer it takes for the court to decide it. But I think the court will be feeling some pressure to get the case out. I would not expect it to come out before Christmas, but maybe January is not right. Not too, yeah, too early to hope for.
Okay, some questions. My friend Dan Morinoff asks, Once SCOTUS locks down what the law is, should we expect the Department of Justice to start filing cases against racial gerrymanders in blue states, either under Shaw versus Reno or Section 2? Do you think it's likely, possible, that they would, the Department of Justice would go on offense against districts in states like California and other blue states?
I think there's there's of course possibility that there would be some of those kinds of suits, but I don't think that those will be terribly significant, because the blue states will draw districts to advantage Democrats. And the court has said, what is obviously true, that of course there's a correlation between race and political ideology and partisanship. And so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for a solidly Democratic state like Massachusetts, say, to get itself into trouble by drawing a district that focuses on race when they could just draw a district that focuses on partisanship and be able to defend their districts on those grounds. I think it will be sufficiently easy for them to draw districts in such a way where it's true that they draw districts for partisan reasons rather than racial ones. And so I don't think that these kind of racial gerrymandering cases are going to turn out to be all that much of a weapon to use against blue states.
Okay, our friend Chuck Bell asked a question I think we've covered, but I'll ask you to add anything else. He asked, do we think if the majority finds the current jingles preconditions to mandate race predominant districting, that the court will rewrite those criteria?
I think so. I'm hopeful that they will. I think that that's the appropriate result. But the question gives me an opportunity to discuss the other alternative that the Calais plaintiffs and the governments, the Louisiana and the United States, are offering here. If Section 2 continues to mean what it has meant since Jingles, and there's therefore a potential conflict between the racial gerrymandering cases in Section 2, and what this would mean is that the states that draw districts with a predominant focus on race would claim that they have a compelling interest in complying with Section 2. The answer could be, no, you don't have a compelling interest in complying with Section 2, because insofar as Section 2 makes you focus on race when you're drawing district lines, Section 2 is unconstitutional. And the basis of that argument would be the court's jurisprudence on Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, the cases about congruence and proportionality under City of Bernie versus Flores. And the argument here, which was explicitly discussed by Justice Barrett, among others, at the oral argument, was that if you have the 15th Amendment, that protects against intentional discrimination against minorities, and maybe something slightly beyond that, that it's not a congruent and proportional response to that constitutional right for Section 2 to create a right to proportional representation on the ground of race. That is to say, when we're talking about congruence and proportionality, when we're talking about Congress's power to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments, Congress can write a statute, but only if that statute is congruent and proportional to the constitutional violations that it's supposed to be remedying or preventing. And if the constitutional violations are very restricted because we're only talking about intentional discrimination or something very close to intentional discrimination, well, then it's not going to be congruent and proportional if you draw a statute that covers much more conduct, that outlaws much more conduct, or that forces states to draw a proportional number of majority-minority districts, because that's so far different from what the 15th Amendment actually requires. And that's the amendment that Congress is ostensibly enforcing through Section 2.
Excellent. Yeah, we haven't covered every single thing, but I'm thrilled that you got some congruence and proportionality into the discussion. And and didn't give me a chance to mispronounce City of Bernie.
Well, I'm sure the people in the San Antonio area will appreciate the argument for the liberal wing of the court is not just that Section 2 would be congruent in proportion, but that the congruence and proportionality test should not apply. And this is an argument that might give Chief Justice Roberts a little bit of heartburn, because number one, the court has never applied the congruence and proportionality test to laws that protect voting rights. It has happened mostly in the context of sovereign immunity, abrogation, and that sort of thing. And in the voting rights cases, the court has applied a much broader, much more deferential test for Congress, the kind of rational basis test from South Carolina versus Katzenbach, Katzenbach versus Morgan, City of Rome from 1980. Those cases give a lot of deference to Congress in deciding how to enforce constitutional voting rights. And so the liberals' first argument is going to be, we don't apply the Bernie test in voting rights claims, we apply this more deferential test. And the more deferential rational basis test from City of Rome is what Chief Justice Roberts applied in his opinion in Allen versus Milligan. So if the court were to decide Calais on the basis of congruence and proportionality, it would be a considerable walking back of Roberts's opinion in Allen versus Milligan, which is another reason why I think the kind of let's reinterpret Jingles approach is going to be far more attractive for the court, and particularly for Roberts, than a straight attack on the constitutionality of Section 2 would be.
Right. Great. Well, I think that's a good place to conclude. We've gone 50 minutes. Mike, I really appreciate everything you've had to say. You did a great job summarizing the issues, and we'll turn it back over.
Thanks very much.
I will echo those thanks to you both. Really appreciate you taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight and summing up this really interesting case. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.